This is Free Speech Radio News, the weekly edition. I'm Nell Abram. Coming up on the program, election 2014 is underway, with voters casting ballots by mail and at early polling. We'll look at record-breaking spending on state judicial elections. California considers a ballot initiative that represents the most sweeping challenge yet to the sentencing law known as Three Strikes. And we'll visit bombed-out schools in Pakistan's Swat Valley to see what, if anything, has improved for students there. Those stories and more on FSRN's Weekly Edition. The 2014 elections are underway around the United States, with voters already casting ballots both at early polling sites and by mail. Tuesday is Election Day, and costly campaign advertising is hitting mailboxes, electronic devices, and TV screens at a rapid rate. In 39 states, many of those ads are for judges fighting to gain or keep their seats on the bench. A recent report from the Brennan Center and Justice at Stake, a nonpartisan organization that tracks money in politics in judicial elections, finds that political parties, outside groups, and state Supreme Court candidates have spent more than $9 million on TV ads this election cycle. FSRN's Shannon Young spoke with Justice at Stake Executive Director Burt Brandenburg about campaign financing of judicial races and what that means for the integrity of the court system.
Campaign contributions to judicial elections don't often receive the same level of attention or scrutiny that legislative or executive elections do. Why is that?
Well, the biggest overlooked story in American politics today is what's been going on in state Supreme Court elections. Around the country, we're seeing campaign fundraising levels records smashed by interest groups and partisans who are essentially trying to buy up courts. And what that's doing is it's turning judges into professional fundraisers. And so you see in state after state since the year 2000, enormous amounts of money coming into judicial elections, and the judges then pressured to raise money from the very parties who appear before them in court.
Your organization, Justice at Stake, recently released a study in partnership with New York University's Brennan Center for Justice, which examined money in judicial elections this campaign season. What trends did you find?
Well, we're finding that in addition to judicial candidates being pressed to raise more and more money to keep or gain their seats, that outside interest groups are flooding the airways as well. So 63% of TV ad spending in judicial races this year so far is by these non-candidate groups. And so now you have big players in politics starting to throw their weight around in judicial elections. Judicial elections were not created for this kind of pressure. They're used to fairly small amounts of money, and when even a modest amount is put in by an outside group, it can really risk tipping a race, but above all, it starts to really put pressure on the judges themselves, and the risk is that they'll start looking over their shoulder at possible campaign contributors or opponents instead of keeping their eye on what's going on in the courtroom. And we know from public opinion research that a majority of Americans think that campaign money is affecting decisions in the courtroom. In fact, nearly 9 out of 10 Americans believe that. We're also seeing research coming out suggesting that in criminal cases, that once the amount of campaign money washing through an election gets to a certain tipping point, the judges will start tilting more towards the prosecution in criminal cases. And the reason for that is that the campaign ads in judicial elections are quite typically run on crime issues. You accuse some judge, no matter what party they are, of somehow being soft on crime because you find some decision somewhere where a defendant didn't get the maximum they could have gotten.
You mentioned spending increased around 2000, but how have judicial campaign spending levels changed since the Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling essentially removed limits on campaign contributions from corporate interests?
Well, it's interesting. The increase in money around judicial elections was underway before Citizens United, but that decision definitely added fuel to the fire. And so we did see a large uptick in the cycle right after that in outside money coming into these races. And there's really a all bets is off mentality now emerging around judicial elections. So they're becoming a lot like elections in other arenas. And that's bad news for a couple reasons. One is that it's never good when races are simply overrun by big money and negative ads. But again, when you think about the role of the courts, it's particularly important. If money affects a decision made by a legislator or an executive, that stinks. if money affects a decision made by a judge, you've just violated the Constitution.
Judges are supposed to recuse themselves from cases in which they may have a conflict of interest. Are those rules binding or voluntary?
Each state that elects judges has some kind of set of rules in place for when a judge should step aside. And the problem is that many of those states have rules that are increasingly becoming out of date. They were not written for an era in which big money was flooding into judicial elections. So right now it's typically up to the judge, and the judge is given a lot of latitude, and what needs to happen is tighter rules need to be set so the judges are more willing and more likely to step aside in certain cases where big money is essentially appearing before them, because the groups that typically give to judges or spend on their behalf, even if it's not a direct contribution, are typically the ones who appear before them in court. Who else would give to a judicial race? So the higher the amount of money grows, the greater the chance there is of a conflict of interest on the part of judges.
What interest groups are spending the most on judicial campaigns this election cycle?
Well, over the past dozen years, it's been a duel between, on the one side, the business community, and on the other side, trial attorneys and labor unions. In general, the business community has had the upper hand. And this particular year, we're seeing largely money coming from a group called the Republican State Leadership Committee, which has targeted a number of states, judicial elections, North Carolina, Tennessee, Montana, and now a district court election in Missouri. We are seeing in Illinois a PAC involving money from trial attorneys trying to oust a particular justice. The other interesting thing we're starting to see is some money coming in from Americans for Prosperity. That's the Koch brothers group. And they have now spent in a couple races this year, not the kind of money they're used to spending in different kinds of races, but the fact that they're in it all is interesting.
Bert Brandenburg is the executive director of Justice at Stake. He joined us by phone from Washington, D.C. For FSRN, I'm Shannon Young.
A ballot initiative in California could result in the early release of one in five inmates in the state's prison system. Supporters of Proposition 47 say it would save the state hundreds of millions of dollars a year by reducing the prison population and diverting the money to drug treatment and education. Prop 47 is the most sweeping challenge yet to the sentencing law known as Three Strikes, which many progressives say is unfair and disproportionate, and which some conservatives and many fiscal conservatives say is unaffordable. FSRN's Larry Buell has more from Los Angeles.
In 1994, California voters passed the nation's toughest sentencing law, one that mandated a minimum 25 to life for a third criminal offense if the first two were felonies. The Three Strikes law came in the wake of the early 90s so-called crack cocaine epidemic, when tough-on-crime rhetoric was a centerpiece of many campaign platforms. To many, Three Strikes seemed sensible. Solve the revolving door of criminal justice by imposing a mandatory minimum sentence for repeat violent offenders and drug users. Similar laws passed in 23 other states. In most, all three offenses must be serious or violent. But in California, the third strike could be for any offense, even a minor offense like petty theft. Now, 20 years later, California voters may choose to roll it back. Proposition 47 would reduce some crimes that are now felonies, such as grand theft, shoplifting, check forgery, and drug possession, to misdemeanors. It would also reduce the length of sentences for those crimes by about a third. Those found guilty would be sent to county facilities instead of state prisons. California law enforcement groups, sheriffs, prosecutors, and many victims' rights groups, the same coalition that pressed for Three Strikes, strongly opposed Prop 47.
Prop 47 calls for, completely rearranging a whole host of crimes.
Christopher Boyd is president of the California Police Chiefs Association. He warns that two key sentence reductions under Prop 47, stealing a gun worth less than $950 and possessing a date rape drug, would put more violent criminals out on the streets.
The proponents are, wanting us to believe that these are low-level crimes, but when you look at the firearms issue and you look at the drugs issue, it's obviously extremely dangerous and really not in the interest of public safety. But no, judges won't have discretion on these crimes listed within Prop 47.
But supporters of 47 point to statistics that show violent crimes are still at historic lows in California, 2 years after voters passed Prop 36, which amended Three Strikes to allow some lifers out early if their third strike conviction was not serious or violent. Karen Lane is Prevention Network Director of Community Coalition in South Los Angeles. She says the tide has turned on public opinion about sentencing, largely due to economic reasons.
California spends $62,000 a year to incarcerate one person. We spend about $7,000 to educate one student in the K-12 system. That's not how they want their resources spent. They want to invest in people. They want to invest in our future and not in holding people in cages for very minor nonviolent crimes.
Religious leaders across the state have also come out in favor of Prop 47. Peter Larman is executive director of Progressive Christians Uniting and project coordinator for Justice Not Jails.
This Prop 47 and everything we're working on, in fact, is changing the frame, changing the model from retributive to restorative justice. And that's a big, big deal for people in the middle, people who are not necessarily crime victims or directly affected, but who do understand that that what we have now isn't working and it's vastly too expensive.
It's not often that a coalition of prison reform advocates, faith leaders, and fiscal conservatives come together on an issue. But the reexamination of sentencing laws is one that crosses ideological boundaries. High-profile supporters of Prop 47 include both rapper Jay-Z and former Republican Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich. Nationwide, the push to roll back mandatory minimum sentencing has a strong supporter in the often-touted 2016 Republican presidential contender, Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky. This summer, Paul and Democratic Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey teamed up to introduce the REDEEM Act, which would let adults with nonviolent offenses seal their criminal records so that they wouldn't be barred from many types of employment. The senators say that the REDEEM Act would help to break the cycle of poverty and violence. REDEEM has little chance of passing in this session of Congress, and neither Paul nor Booker has weighed in on Prop 47. But legal scholars say that if it passes, Prop 47 could set a precedent for changes in many other states. Kareem Creighton is an associate professor of law at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
If the California Project is successful and you can show that these new orientations around criminal justice actually lead to savings and doesn't lead to an increase in crime, certainly violent crimes, I think most states will look at that favorably and think, hey, here's a way that we can actually continue to do our job as cops and prison officials, but also do it in a smart way. So a legislator might well look at this system and say, you know what, I need to figure out ways of incorporating that into the way that we do business. Governors, prosecutors, and the like can also do that as well.
Polling shows that Prop 47 stands a decent chance of passing. Other states are watching the results closely because, as California goes, at least prison reform advocates hope, so goes the nation. For Free Speech Radio News in Los Angeles, I'm Larry Buell.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. You'll find more of our work, along with information about how you can support it, at fsrn.org. 40 years ago, in the wake of the Watergate scandal, Congress passed the Privacy Act, along with amendments to bolster the Freedom of Information Act. These two pieces of legislation sought to not only better govern the records held by federal agencies, but also make them more available to the public. Freedom of information has come a long way since, but advocates say there are still improvements to be made. Legislation now pending in Congress may be the best chance in years for enacting FOIA reforms. Ashley Westerman reports from Washington, D.C.
There's the mail right here. Is all the FOIA docs coming in.
Nate Jones, the Freedom of Information Act coordinator at the National Security Archive, gives me a tour around their office. The nonprofit research institution collects and publishes declassified government information obtained through FOIA.
This is what we call the vault.
Located on George Washington University's campus, the space is full of boxes upon boxes of files, lining the hallways, stacked in offices, and stuffed on shelves that stretch from floor to ceiling. There are thousands of documents in this small space, but the greatest hits, as Jones likes to call them, are framed on the wall.
Here's one of a document saying that the heat from destroying these tapes of torture is nothing compared to what would happen if the tapes ever got into the public domain. So that's the fight we're fighting.
Jones estimates there are about 500 boxes altogether. That's about 1% of the organization's entire inventory of documents requested from the government or donated by journalists and other advocates of freedom of information. Jones says his job would be much harder if the Freedom of Information Act, originally passed in 1966, hadn't been bolstered by the amendments added to it 40 years ago. He adds the government tends to pick and choose what information to voluntarily disclose.
So the Freedom of Information Act and the teeth it gained in the 74 amendments gave the public and journalists a tool to fight for information that they want from the government. And the government then has to say why it should remain secret. So it swung to a presumption of disclosure when an individual requests it.
Jones says even though freedom of information in the U.S. has come a long way since then, more can be done. For example, it could reform the measure known as Exemption 5, which allows the government to withhold any inter- or intra-planning information. This catch-all Exemption 5 is just one aspect of current U.S. freedom of information law the FOIA Improvement Act of 2014 seeks to amend. Sponsored by Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont, the legislation is awaiting a hearing with the Senate Judiciary Committee. Leahy is chairman of that committee. Over the last year, FOIA reform has proven to be a bipartisan issue. The House version of the FOIA reform bill, the FOIA Oversight and Implementation Act, was passed unanimously earlier this year. That bill, co-authored by California Republican Representative Daryl Issa and Maryland Democratic Representative Elijah Cummings, seeks to make a number of changes, including furthering a previous executive memo by President Barack Obama that said all federal agencies should have a presumption that disclosure is the law of the land. Here's co-author Issa speaking to the House floor on behalf of the bill in February.
This shifts the burden of proof from the public requester seeking information about a government agency's with which he must now demonstrate that he has the need, to the government being open and transparent unless it has a good reason to withhold.
The FOIA Improvement Act, the bill still waiting in Congress, also seeks to lock in that presumption. Amy Bennett, assistant director of OpenTheGovernment.org, says it's the gold standard in international freedom of information.
That the law needs to have some sort of a presumption that it's the public's information and the government is just the temporary holder.
Among other provisions, the law also seeks to deal with Exemption 5 by applying a balancing test that will weigh the public interest in the decision to disclose the information, as well as add a 25-year sunset to the exemption. Bennett says these planning records are important to understand how policy is developed. And Congress isn't the only one looking to improve access to government information. The Freedom of Information Advisory Committee, which was established in 2013 as part of the U.S.'s participation in the Worldwide Open Government Partnership, is a group of government and non-government members that seeks to improve access to information. Bennett, who attended the committee's quarterly meeting last week, says both sides of the group have a lot of good ideas about proactive disclosure. She adds the more proactive the government is about disclosing information, the less FOIA requests, backlogs, and wait time there will be.
That's not how FOIA is supposed to work. It's supposed to be a timely way to get government information. So I think that proactive disclosure can lessen some of that volume and help us move through the process more quickly. But we're always going to need a FOIA because there's always going to be something that the government doesn't want to release.
Bennett says as FOIA stands now, it's far too bureaucratic for the public. There are more than 99 agency portals in which to submit a FOIA request, and not a timely enough system for journalists and newsmakers. Passing the FOIA Improvement Act would improve these shortcomings in the law, along with many others.
Here's my office. Here's the box where the documents come in all the time again.
Back at the National Security Archive, Nate Jones says despite the act dying three times over the years in the Senate Judiciary Committee, now that the House has passed its version of a FOIA reform bill.
So now the forecast looks better for Sunshine than it ever has been.
FOIA reform advocates hope the bill is bipartisan enough to pass, but Congress doesn't return until November, after the midterm elections. This gives them only a small window to pass the FOIA Improvement Act before the new Congress takes over in January. Ashley Westerman, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
This year, Pakistani teen Malala Yousafzai shared the Nobel Peace Prize for her work advocating for education and peace in Pakistan's Swat Valley. On Wednesday, She was also awarded the World's Children's Prize. The recipient is chosen by a global ballot with votes cast only by children. At the award ceremony, Yousafzai said she will donate the entire $50,000 purse to help rebuild UN-run schools in the Gaza Strip. As a preteen, Yousafzai blogged about the dangers, particularly for girls, of seeking an education in the region under Taliban occupation. While aboard a bus, she was shot in the head by militants in an assassination attempt. Taliban militants have destroyed more than 3,000 schools in the Pakistani regions near the border with Afghanistan, and attacks still happen regularly. Fakhar Kakakel travels to the tribal areas to visit schools and find out how students and educators are faring.
These children are among thousands in Pakistan who have lost their school in a bomb blast. According to local authorities, militants have blown up more than 3,000 schools in the Pakistani region bordering Afghanistan in the last 5 years. But rather than give up on education in the face of threats from Taliban militants, some teachers and students continue to hold classes under the open sky. Among them is 7-year-old Aisha, not her real name. A bomb blast in August this year destroyed her school completely. Aisha is studying English and Urdu and wants to be a teacher when she grows up. While some teachers make a brave attempt to keep offering classes, only the dedicated students continue their education years after an attack. Sherzad teaches a small group of students in the remains of a school that was bombed by militants in June of 2011.
Our school was bombed on the 2nd of June at around 8 o'clock p.m. The next morning we had no building. None of the children appeared on that day. We waited for weeks to start classes. We're scared, but are thankful that at least the militants are not killing us. We have heard that Japan has sent funding to bomb schools, but we haven't seen developments. Children are seeking education in an environment of fear and stress. These are really brave students. During harsh weather, we have to call off classes.
Near the town of Shapkadar, a group of teachers from a bombed-out school tried to hold classes in tents. But the next morning, Taliban militants set the tents on fire. Teacher Awai Khan describes what happened.
When our school was destroyed, we weren't surprised. There are school blasts weekly, if not daily. Since we lost the building and everything in it, we asked the government to provide tents. We also borrowed some chairs, boards, and furniture from the neighboring schools. We started our tent school, but we and our students were still feeling threatened. Dozens of children dropped out. After 3 weeks of the tent school in the evening, militants stormed the school again, set the tents on fire, and left. The next day, there was nothing left except ashes. Our school was the only school for the town's 5,000 families. Now, few of the children take the risk to attend schools out of town.
Officials say the destruction of school is part of the extremist mind because militants oppose raising awareness through education. Parliamentary member in the Standing Committee for Education, Sardar Hussain Babak, explains.
More than 4,000 schools we have lost partially, we have lost fully damaged. And despite that, you know, we were facing financial problems also due to militancy, due to the floods. Very crucial time, very difficult time, we spare enough funds for education. We have completed in our own government more than 60% reconstructive process we have completed. So now I think so operation is going on in Waziristan, so definitely it will react here.
While the role of militants in attack is clear, some would also say the government response lacks of commitment, planning and coordination. Amar Sher is a former teacher at the Subhan Khwar Government High School, which has survived 2 suicide attacks and 4 bomb blasts.
After suicide attacks killed school security guards, I tried my best to continue, but there are issues at the management level. The international community has sent billions of dollars, but nobody is asking where these dollars went. I stayed on for a while. Believe me, there are no records for half of the funds. The school rebuilding efforts in the federally administered tribal area has become a gift to corrupt local officials. Hundreds of schools have been built in areas where they are not needed. We know the global community has given generously to rebuild schools, but no one is following up to see what happens.
6:30 a.m. Wake up.
Extremism and corruption has trapped the region's children in a Cage-22 situation. Education is seen by many as the best way to counter extremism, but the biggest hurdle to rebuilding the region's devastated education infrastructure is the corruption of local officials. For now, the education of future generations has become a high-risk endeavor for a small number of brave teachers and students and the parents who support them. Sayed Fakhar Kakakhil, FSRN, Peshawar.
On college campuses from Washington to Florida, from Maine to Southern California, university students, faculty, and community members took part in a National Day of Action Wednesday against sexual assault. Participants in the so-called Carry That Weight actions carried mattresses and pillows in solidarity with Emma Sulkowitz, a Columbia University student who was raped in 2012 by a man she knew. A university panel found the man not responsible because Sulkowitz had agreed to sex with him twice before. She's been carrying a mattress with her wherever she goes, drawing attention to the weight of the burden borne by rape survivors. A recently enacted law in California is the first affirmative consent law, known as Yes Means Yes. According to the law, silence, or the lack of a no, does not mean an individual has consented to a sexual encounter, including while sleeping or intoxicated. Critics say the law makes sexual relations more complicated, but UCLA student Savannah Badalich says it's quite the opposite. The 21-year-old rape survivor is part of the White House's Presidential Task Force on Preventing and Responding to Sexual Violence. She's also the founder of 7,000 in Solidarity, a campaign against sexual assault. Badalich provided input to the language of the law, specifically to a clause that provides medical amnesty for alcohol consumption to the survivor. Badalich explains.
Many survivors and witnesses to a sexual assault, whether it was before it was happening or what have you, were afraid of coming forward because they were afraid of being sanctioned by the university for underage drinking or drinking period during the entire encounter. Somehow they'll get in trouble for doing that. Now under it, it basically gives them amnesty or medical amnesty, where if they decide, if they report or if they're a witness to a sexual violence and they're helping with the report, they will be basically not sanctioned for coming forward. It's no longer a barrier for reporting.
Badalich says the vast majority of campus sexual assaults are committed by serial perpetrators who know what they're doing is wrong. The Yes Means Yes legislation will likely not change their behavior, but Badalich hopes it will change the climate around the issue on campus.
When you educate the peers, you're changing the culture on campus from one of silence and stigma to one of healing and support. What we're hoping to do is by having the peers understand what's going on, when someone comes forward, they're not going to be silenced. I mean, the first person that you talk to about your assault is more likely to be your friend than it is to be an administrator or a police officer. So if your friend doesn't believe you, why would you go to the criminal justice system? Why would you go to the adjudication process at your own university? You're not going to. So if we can talk about what is consent and what isn't consent and how you can have rights and resources, maybe instead of saying, well, why did you go out last night? Why were you wearing that? Why were you drinking? It could change that to, I'm so sorry that you had to go through that. Let's figure out what we can do.
That was UCLA student Savannah Badalich, a rape survivor and advocate for affirmative sexual consent laws to combat rape culture on college campuses. And that does it for this week's program. FSRN is supported by the radio stations that carry our show and by listeners like you. More information is at fsrn.org. From Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram. Thanks for listening.